Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. From my cubicle at work, I can see the Philadelphia Police Headquarters, the Roundhouse, as we call it, because of its distinct shape. The last few days, members of the National Guard with automatic weapons have been standing there. The National Guard was called into Philadelphia after protests against police violence last weekend escalated. Helicopters have been flying over the city nonstop. Protests continue, police everywhere, roads are closed, and we've had a curfew. The marches and rallies against police violence sparked by the killing of George Floyd at the hands of police are happening all over the country. They are once again bringing an issue to the forefront that is part of everyday life for many.
As I turned 40, I had the realization that I have been stopped by police more times than my age. I've been stopped while driving cars, sitting in parked cars, riding on buses and trains, walking, running, studying, eating, and clubbing. I've been cussed out, thrown up against walls, and arrested by police.
That's Rayshon Ray. He is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Maryland, College Park. He is also a Rubenstein Fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he wrote an essay called Bad Apples Come from Rotten Trees in Policing.
As the father of two black boys, I worry about the moment they will go from cute to criminal in the eyes of so many people. How people will dehumanize their minds, weaponize their blackness, and criminalize their bodies.
As a little kid, Rayshon thought about police in a totally different way. A lot of his family members were police officers.
They have always been a group of people who I viewed as a place where I could go for safety, where I could go for refuge, where I could have a conversation with.
When he was about 10, he noticed another side of police. He was living in Atlanta.
Seeing police officers have some black teenagers handcuffed, face down on the asphalt, similar to the way we've seen George Floyd.
He remembers going to a baseball game with his mom, and he saw a Klan rally.
And police officers were standing there, as were firefighters, just having a very casual conversation with the Klan.
Now, as a sociologist, Rayshon studies policing. He's interviewed hundreds of officers. He's worked with different police departments. He's interested in finding out what contributes to racial equity in policing.
So are there some best practices? Are there some factors that we can put into a statistical model that tell us what good policing looks like?
His research looks at biases and prejudice officers may have.
And then how do these attitudes and people's physiological reactions, which we're able to measure with our virtual reality simulations that we have officers go into, we can measure officers' heart rates, their stress level, their reaction time, their eye movement. How do all these factors come and impact behavioral outcomes? And at the end of the day, what we want to see is that officers react the same way to black people as they do to white people.
Like Rayshon, researchers all over the country and the world are studying policing. What's the role of science in all of this? You know, I think police departments and scientific research haven't always gone hand in hand.
I mean, you're exactly right. And I feel like that I sit at that intersection. I think science is vital. The same way that scientific evidence is vital for COVID-19, we also need data and science-driven approaches to deal with policing. And one thing I will say, though, is that a lot of the police chiefs that I interact with, they are very data-driven. And the more data that they're provided, the better decisions they actually make. For pretty much every department that I've interacted with, when I show them their data, where their gaps are, whether or not they're more likely to exhibit bias based on race or based on gender, based on place, and we talk about what are solutions to this, they are really open to dealing with those solutions. I think part of the problem is that rarely do we have complete data to paint a fully scientific and statistical portrait. And that's really what I've been doing, is building up databases on police officers and policing that can then help us make better decisions moving forward.
On today's show, what could better policing look like? And what are we learning about the impact of police violence on people's health? Let's start with health issues that are connected to police violence. This past weekend, a young black protester in Minneapolis, filmed by CNN, expressed what it's like to live in constant fear of police.
I want to be able, when a cop is driving behind me, I don't have to clench and be tense, okay? I want to be able just to be free and not have to think about every step I take. Because at the end of the day, being black is a crime. At the end of the day, being born black is a crime to them. And I don't understand why, because we're all humans.
You can hear the stress and exhaustion in his voice. Harvard University public health researcher David Williams studies the impact of police violence on people's health. He says fear of police is one big issue, and he told me about how this affected a friend of his.
He was a successful businessman, but he was a young African-American male. And if his wife needed him to go to the supermarket and pick up a gallon of milk, he would go first to his bedroom, put on a jacket and tie, before he went out to run this simple errand. Because if for him, it was one way of minimizing the chances that he will be taken for some thug who's about to commit a crime.
This has come up in David's life, too. He says his wife is worried about him all the time, and
my two daughters were driving along the road one day in Massachusetts a few years ago, and they heard on the news, they were listening to a news station, and it says, African-American Harvard professor arrested by the police. And they pulled over because they wondered, could that be daddy? You know, and it turned out it was my colleague Skip Gates who got arrested by the police ultimately for entering his own apartment. But I mean, it's they lived with it. They were immediately stressed because they saw themselves that this could be real, this could hit home. We know that in terms of the negative effects of stress on health, it's not just what you actually experience, but if you are protecting yourself, thinking about what might happen, and taking precautionary steps, that is a higher level of psychological, physiological vigilance that you are maintaining because of your perception of the environment is dangerous. I'll tell you about a body of research. It's what's called an ambulatory blood pressure study. You take blacks and whites who don't have hypertension, and you hook them up to a little device that takes their blood pressure levels at random intervals over the course of the day and night. They wear it while they sleep. And they found among these young, healthy African-Americans and whites, there were no racial differences in blood pressure during the day. But at night, when blacks and whites were sleeping, blacks maintained higher levels of blood pressure even while they're sleeping. What was happening is for everyone, when you fall asleep, your blood pressure declines. Blacks have a decline, but it's a smaller decline than whites. It's almost as if the environment is that dangerous that you have to sleep with one eye open. You cannot ever fully relax. Being in this state of vigilance, of protecting oneself, has negative consequences for health.
David and some of his colleagues recently studied mental health in places where a police shooting has happened.
And what we were able to document was that a police shooting of an unarmed African-American male leads to more mental health problems, not just for his family and friends who knew him, but for the entire black population in that state for up to 3 months after the event. So it illustrates that this negative experience that has received publicity is adversely affecting the mental health of the entire black population who lived in that state in which that police shooting occurred.
That's David Williams. He's a public health researcher and professor at Harvard University. Pediatrician Rhea Boyd has been trying to bring attention to the issue of police violence among her medical colleagues for years.
What did people say when I said this in 2014 and 2015 and 2016 and 2017 and 2018 and 2019, for the majority of healthcare leadership that I spoke to, it was, this isn't our problem, and this isn't a population-level health issue. What you're describing, Rhea, is a one-on-one encounter between one individual bad cop and one unlucky civilian. And what people have failed to understand, that I hope they are now grasping, is that police violence is the result of a systematic problem.
Rhea says fearing violence and witnessing violence has a big impact on kids. Increased anxiety, depression, trouble sleeping, which can lead to trouble in school.
But for Black kids in particular, and I want to say this, seeing these images right now in the setting of a pandemic that we've also been consuming the racial inequities around, has a really profound impact on how they perceive their own Blackness and their risks for death in the world. Kids' relationship to their own Blackness is called their racial socialization. And two Black psychologists decades ago performed those landmark seminal studies, the doll studies, that showed that as early as 3 and 4, preschool age kids understand what it means to be Black in the world. And they understand that it's negative. Right now, we are adding to that negative racial socialization such that kids understand that being Black in the world also puts them at risk of dying. That will change how kids move in the world.
Rhea says with everything happening right now, parents should check in with their kids.
And ask them what they already know and how has that affected you. And then hold space and listen to how your child is feeling. And then it's really important to validate what they say. To say, I understand. That makes sense. I feel like that sometimes too. So for kids who are expressing negative emotions or fears related to what they've seen, sometimes just some encouragement and reassuring words about what you're doing to keep them safe can help.
Rhea Boyd is a pediatrician and a child and community health advocate in the Bay Area. The demonstrations that are happening all over the country have been mostly peaceful, but there have been clashes between protesters and police. We've seen police pelting people with rubber bullets, officers beating protesters with their batons, using tear gas, and we've seen protesters hurl rocks and set police cars on fire. Last year, Pulse reporter Alan Yu traveled to Hong Kong, the city where he grew up, to cover the protest movement there. Alan was interested in the issue of police and crowd control, how and when violence erupts, and what role police play in that. And just recently, Alan covered the protests happening in Philadelphia. So we wanted to listen back to some of his story about crowd control and then hear about his new experiences. Alan, the story you did last year started in Hong Kong with one of the more controversial early protests that happened there in July.
Yes, so during this protest in Hong Kong, there were thousands of people. They were gathering peacefully, but then the police officers who were there used pepper spray against some of the protesters, and the protesters started barricading roads, and then the police in riot gear showed up and sort of surrounded the protesters. And then the protesters escaped to a nearby shopping mall, and that's where the clashes continued.
Okay, so let's pick up the story you reported last year from here.
That protest in July did not end well. The police arrested more than 40 people. An officer had his finger bitten off. The Hong Kong police did not want to comment on this story. But I did talk to my friend's father, who was a police officer there for 30 years. He agreed to talk to me, but I'm not going to use his name. He retired in 2015 as a chief inspector, and he's still very connected to friends on the force. And he says the protests in Hong Kong just got out of control.
Recently, they threw three petrol bombs on two motorcycle police officers. And one of the officers, he was a friend of mine. Can you imagine if in States, if the police got attacked by petrol bombs, I think they will already open fire.
Situations involving crowds can change very quickly. Panic can suddenly spread. People can become on edge, angry or violent. So what have police learned about handling those situations? Is there even a standard? Owen West was a police officer for 30 years. Before he retired this July, he was the chief superintendent of the West Yorkshire Police in the UK, which has around 5,000 officers.
It's ingrained and embedded within police culture that the police are there to control a crowd situation, that to lose control would be a bad thing, that to have people break a police line or defeat a police tactic is in a sense a defeat for the police.
Owen says that back in the 80s, when he became a police officer, he was taught to contain, disperse and arrest unruly crowds. Police could use riot gear, cars, horses, tear gas, batons, water cannons, but
very little in those days was known about the psychology of crowds. So we were in effect implementing tactics without knowing the science behind the way that people behave in a crowd, what motivates crowds, how crowds respond to particular inputs from the police.
There wasn't a lot of research back then. And in fact, bringing science into policing wasn't really a thing.
This is around a police sense of identity, which is you have to be a police officer to understand policing. And I've often heard colleagues say, you know, what can an academic teach me about policing? What can an academic tell me about life on the streets?
But Owen thought academia could offer some insight. In fact, he welcomed a researcher into his police force, Clifford Stott, a social psychologist. Owen let Clifford ride along with his officers, have all the same access that Owen had. In return, they collaborated on science-based crowd control tactics. Clifford wanted to challenge a long-held belief about crowds, that they have a mob mentality and are inherently dangerous.
When people enter a crowd, psychologically, their normal way of controlling their behaviour through consciousness disappears as a function of becoming anonymous.
Clifford does not agree with that. He says crowds have a purpose, they have an identity, they are there for a reason.
If we think about the situation in Hong Kong, one of the things that must be defining protesters' shared identity is their shared struggle for what they perceive to be democracy in Hong Kong, in a context where they feel that that democracy is being threatened by the Chinese government.
The way he understands it, there's a social identity to crowds. And Clifford argues that heavy-handed policing actually makes things worse. Because once the crowd gets angry with the police, their reason for being there can shift. Now it's about being angry at the police, on top of what their initial demands were. And Clifford says that has implications.
Most notably that the authorities, and in particular the police, can often have a profound role to play in producing the very violence that they pretend to stop.
Clifford says that means the police are not passive third-party peacekeepers. They play a part in what happens. Owen says even what police officers wear can make a difference.
So if you go to a protest and you see officers that are dressed for riot, you see them dressed in body armour, you see them carrying shields, having batons drawn, then obviously that is a very intimidating, a very difficult context.
So if not riot gear and shields and tear gas, what could the police do instead? Owen, the superintendent working with Clifford, says you should find out what the crowd wants. He tried this out a few years ago. There was a soccer game on in West Yorkshire. About 100 fans gathered in a bar. Some were on the street, some had probably been drinking. Owen's officers wanted to do what they've always done, control the crowd.
To march them up to the football stadium, to use police horses, to use a number of police officers, and to use the police helicopter in terms of sort of being above them to keep surveillance on them.
But Owen wanted to draw on the work he had done with Clifford, so he chose a different tactic. Instead, he asked some officers to wear a different coloured jacket, blue instead of yellow. These officers went into the bar, talked to fans. Some were curious about the new uniforms. The officers found out these fans just wanted to get to the game. The officers reported back to Owen. The police worked with cab drivers to bring people to the game in small groups. Owen did not have to use any riot gear, and there was no violence. That's not to say that the police liked it.
There was a lot of nervousness about it. There was a lot of fear that we were essentially handing this problem over to a small number of officers rather than the many that we had available to us.
But over time, this approach gained traction. Owen says the crowd control tactics that he and Clifford worked on together is now mainstream among UK police. Here in the US, in Madison, Wisconsin, more than 40 years ago, a young police chief had actually reached similar conclusions about how to handle crowds. David Cooper was in his 30s, and he came face to face with the anti-war protests of the 1970s. He started in 1972. Before David got to Madison, some of the protests there went notoriously out of control. In 1967, students threw rocks at police. The police used tear gas, beat students with clubs. David got there and told his officers, "We are not doing any of that."
We passed out handouts and saying, "Look, we're here. We're here to accompany this protest. Our job is to facilitate your ability to protest, to regulate traffic around you, and we want to work with you."
He asked his officers to wear a blue blazer, hide their weapons, and just talk to the protesters instead of going in with force.
Needless to say, that was not something in which at first the community said, "Oh, Chief, what a great idea that is. We should have thought of this a long time ago."
Quite the opposite.
Shortly after that, they tried to fire me for about 2 years.
But the mayor supported him, and so did a lot of the younger officers. David stayed police chief in Madison for 21 years. Police officers now know his crowd control tactics as the Madison Method. But many police departments are not using the more science-based approach and deal with protests in a heavy-handed way. Owen, our superintendent from the UK, says there's a lot on the line, and it can feel scary to change tactics or try something new.
You know, you will lose control of this, there will be disorder, there might be violence, there might be a riot. And so in many respects for commander colleagues, it's a much more comfortable life to stick with what you know and not to innovate, particularly within a crowd context.
But there is more to it than just police officers being resistant to change. I talked to Tamara Harold. She's an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. She wrote two crowd policing guides for the U.S. Department of Justice. Tamara agrees with what David and Owen are saying, but she understands why the police don't always follow her advice.
So imagine an officer pulling over a driver and deciding whether or not to give a ticket. There's tremendous amount of dynamics associated with that, and whether that person leaves angry or, you know, satisfied. Now you multiply that, you know, by thousands, by tens of thousands of individuals interacting and reacting to the police, and it grows in complexity, obviously, tremendously.
So I talked to my friend's father, the retired police officer in Hong Kong, and he brought up yet another point. As far as what you've seen, what the Hong Kong police have been doing, would you say it's worked?
This is not a police thing to solve. It is the central government. You know, it's all political issue. We are just the tool. We cannot solve political problem.
That story was reported by Alan Yu last year. Alan traveled to Hong Kong to report on the protest movement there, and now he's been covering the protest against police violence in Philadelphia. Alan, when you were covering the protests in Philadelphia, things started out totally peacefully and then eventually turned violent. So tell me about some of the moments that stand out to you from that day, Saturday.
Yeah, at first it was a totally peaceful protest. It was just people marching and chanting and listening to speeches. And things took a bit of a turn once we hit a particular intersection where the Pennsylvania State Troopers were waiting. And a small number, maybe a handful of protesters started smashing one of the Pennsylvania State Troopers' car. There was no one inside the car, but they smashed the windshield. They tossed what looked like a signal flare inside the car, started burning. At first, the police just watched the car burn, but then they started pushing people back to form a perimeter around the burning car. Then more and more officers showed up and started really separating the large crowd into smaller groups. And they started really shoving people back, and there was nowhere to go. It wasn't clear where the officers wanted people to be. And that's when the atmosphere became much more heated. Now, they eventually did disperse, went back down to City Hall, but then there was an armored SWAT van there, and some of the officers inside were spraying protesters from inside the van, and that made some of the people very angry, and they started smashing and set fire to two parked and empty police cars at City Hall, and that's when I think the protest really took a turn.
Now, in your story on crowd control, which you reported last year, there was a lot of advice on how police forces could do this better. So, did you see any do's and don'ts during this protest?
Yes, and I have to say, at first, the police officers were, you know, doing pretty well. They stood by, they directed traffic a little bit just to make sure that, you know, no cars got in people's way. And so at first, I thought this would end fine. But then we move on to the don'ts. And once the police officers showed up with riot gear, with helmets, with batons, and especially when the armored SWAT van showed up and started spraying the protesters, that's when I thought, I recall the experts telling police officers to precisely not to do that kind of thing with a peaceful crowd. And the other thing that stood out to me was the importance of communication. It's very important for the police officers to be in constant contact with the crowd. It wasn't really clear to the protest group what the officers really wanted, and there would be at times contradictory directions. So I thought there was a real breakdown in communication there, which I remember as being another vital aspect to doing crowd policing well.
So nobody knew where they were supposed to go, right?
Yeah, and all they would say was, you know, move back. But then once we move back, the officers would say, go back the other way. So it was clear that even between the officers themselves, they were not clear on what the direction was.
Were you scared at any point? I mean, you were right in the middle of this.
I mean, it did get a little bit scary. I mean, more so in that I was just pressed up against protesters with nowhere else to go. So it was like, you know, being in a crammed subway car where the walls were slowly closing in. I thought that there would be, like, you know, a stampede or something. And, you know, thankfully that did not happen there. So I guess that was the moment when I thought that we were in probably the most danger.
And I guess after 2 months of social distancing, that must have felt so weird.
Yes, it was very strange to be around that many humans again. We all had all the protesters had our masks on, but yes, it had been a very long time since I had really stood that close to another person.
You reached out to some of the experts you featured in your reporting in the story we just heard. What's their take on what has happened in the U.S., what continues to happen in the U.S. right now?
Yeah, so I reached out to two of the experts I talked to. One was Owen West. He's a retired chief superintendent of police in the UK. And he was quite frank. He said that he was horrified by some of the tactics that he saw the police in the US using.
I have seen groups corralled and trapped in a space that they cannot exit from. I've seen them have CS spray deployed on them, again without exit. I've seen tactics that appear to me to be designed more to punish a crowd than to achieve any overarching public order type of advantage to the police.
You know, for the most part, he was quite worried at what he was seeing from his police colleagues in the US, though he did see some moments of good leadership, and he hopes that that is what police departments will learn.
That's Pulse reporter Alan Yu. During several recent protests across the country, police used tear gas, which seemed to be the moment when things went from bad to worse.
Tear gas is meant to be used as a weapon of last resort. It's a dispersal agent designed to disperse an entire assembly when it gets riotous. But that's not how it's being used now.
That's Rohini Har. She's an emergency medicine physician in Oakland, California. She says these weapons are often used on peaceful protesters, on crowds that are already walking away. A few years ago, she co-authored a report for Physicians for Human Rights that looked at the health effects of crowd control weapons like tear gas.
It is a weapon. It's certainly not what is commonly known as a non-lethal weapon. And so the majority of the permanent injuries and severe damage we saw were either from direct blunt trauma from the canisters. So when the canisters were either targeted or hit people's heads, eyes, neck, delicate structures of their face, things like that, or from excessive use. So especially to the respiratory system, if too much gets in, or if it gets into, say, a child or an elderly person or someone with asthma, that can cause some pretty permanent injuries as well.
Tear gas was first used by militaries. Today, all chemical irritants are actually banned by the Chemical Weapons Convention for use by the military in war or conflict. But for police forces,
the problem now is that because there's almost no regulation on tear gas or crowd control weapons, police departments want to buy the newest, latest, most potent, most effective thing. And manufacturers develop those. And so there's new types and styles and dispersal mechanisms every year. What we see are concerning trends in terms of mixing weapons. Sometimes we see pepper balls, which are essentially like rubber bullets or paintballs with pepper spray inside them, things like that. And obviously using two of these weapons together is really dangerous. And then trying to increase how effective these weapons are is totally unnecessary because they're overused already.
Rohini Har is an emergency medicine physician in Oakland, California. We're talking about police violence, how it impacts our health, and what factors contribute to it. Coming up, what are the changes that could reduce police violence?
We need a national database on police killings. So we know how many people get the flu every year. And we actually know how many people get killed by jellyfish. But we don't know how many people are killed by police every year. I think that should bother everyone.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about police violence, its impact on people's health, and what researchers are learning about its causes. police officers are on alert all the time. The job is dangerous. They often have to make decisions in split seconds while under a lot of stress. They bring their own biases and prejudices into situations, which can affect who they will consider a threat or how much force they will use. In situations like that, our brains kick into predictive mode, says Karen Quigley, a psychology professor at Northeastern University.
I'm predicting what I think is likely to happen next, and I do that on the basis of what I know from my past, having been in similar contexts.
But the prediction can be wrong. Karen says prediction errors happen more frequently when the body is activated or on high alert. Your heart is pumping, your stomach feels tight.
And here's the interesting thing, right? Which is that we sometimes feel our bodies feel activated for a whole variety of reasons. So if I just had 3 cups of coffee, I'm going to be feeling a bit activated. I might feel that way if I've had too little sleep. I might feel that way if I'm super hungry. All of those things can feel rather similar to our brains.
So the brain only knows that the body is freaking out. Something is different, but the brain doesn't know why. Maybe you're tired, you're hungry, had too much coffee, and now add to that a traffic stop or a dangerous situation where the officer has to make a decision in the blink of an eye. Is the other person a threat or not?
When we're activated, we can sometimes make poorer decisions, particularly when we haven't ever made those decisions in an activated state before.
The officer could underestimate a threat or use too much force and harm or even kill a civilian. According to a database that the Washington Post is keeping, in the past year, police have shot and killed more than 1,000 people. More than 320 were unarmed. African Americans are shot and killed at a disproportionately high rate. All kinds of things could have come into play in any one of these situations. But psychologist Judith Anderson says better training based on science could help. Judith is at the University of Toronto, Mississauga, and she has developed a training for police officers where they are put into simulated high-stress situations, and their physical response is measured with monitors.
They have this kind of jump activation in heart rate. The way they breathe and the way they held their body and how conflictual the event became, you can see it's like a window into your body.
Judith says just seeing the reaction happen is helpful for officers. Understanding what's going on in their body during a traffic stop or when they've gotten a call. This physical reaction can make us more focused, more aware, but it can also push us into fight or flight mode, where we might make irrational decisions. In the training, officers learn how to calm their bodies down, and quickly.
We call this like a single breath reset. And when they do this, they can drop their heart rate for a few seconds, and it gives them a brief window in which they can reappraise the situation. Their kind of brain comes online. And then they can think about, okay, what does my training say in this situation?
You can do this breathing sitting down or standing up as long as you're not hunched over because that squeezes your lungs.
You take a really deep breath. You're holding it for 1 second at the top of the breath, and it's pursed lips breathing. So pushing the air through your lips with pursed lips. And that air just gets pushed out, tightening in the core, pushing that air through, down through your body. And you can see it on the monitor, the heart rate monitor, it just drops the heart rate. It's like a manual override to drop your heart rate. And that lasts for about a second or two. Then you breathe normally, because obviously if you kept doing that, you would hyperventilate.
And does it make a noise? So if you're, when you're breathing out, does it go like...
Well, it's interesting because naturally you've probably seen people when they get angry, they puff up their cheeks and their body's actually trying to do that, but they're not being very effective at it because they haven't practiced doing it in a smooth manner. And as you practice, you can get it so that your face doesn't look weird. You don't have to puff up your cheeks. You're just really slowing that out breath. We have people actually think about drop your heart rate. You're pushing that heart rate down by your breath.
Judith and her team have evaluated the effects of this training in several studies. For example, they found that groups that received the training made less than half of the mistakes in final test scenarios compared to untrained officers. Judith says police departments in Europe have been very open to this approach. For example, it's taught to every officer in Finland. But Canadian and American police departments have been a bit more reluctant.
There has interestingly been a resistance to addressing one's own internal processes, almost like it was a weakness or so forth. But how we've tried to educate people about this is like, we are human. These are natural human stress responses. You will have them, like it or not. You have to learn to modify that.
Judith Anderson is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. Joseph Fridman helped produce this segment. The death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police officers sparked outrage and protests in every part of the country. But the relationship between the police and the public, especially in communities of color, have long been fraught with tension, mistrust, and abuse. Many are calling for a total overhaul of how policing is done in this country. I talked about that with Tracy Mears. She is a law professor at Yale Law School and founding director of the Justice Collaboratory. She studies how people think about their relationship with police and other parts of the criminal justice system, especially when it comes to fairness.
Our research shows that when people come to conclusions about the fairness of authorities such as police, they care so much more about how they're treated by these authorities as opposed to the outcomes that police produce.
That kind of finding has led to police departments trying to have better relationships with communities, spend more time getting to know people, do foot patrol. Here is Philadelphia officer Bill Robbins describing his approach.
Talking to people, talking to the community, talking to the store owners, met a lot of great people, you know.
But Tracy Mears says that's not what she's talking about.
Many people take some of our research and think that, you know, policing can be carried out as it's always been carried out and just tinkered along the edges, right? Police simply should be more polite to people. And that's not really the basis of our research at all. You know, the basis of our research, frankly, is that policing needs to be done fundamentally differently, focused on cooperation and engagement with members of the public, rather than trying to figure out how to use force in a better and nicer way.
To really improve the relationship between the public and the police, Tracy says you have to completely reframe what you think of as the role of police.
We need to reverse the current understanding of how police actually relate to members of the public. It's not about how members of the public help police do their jobs. It's really about coming up with a true understanding of having police carry out the goals and projects that members of the public articulate. And I think one of the ways we see that the clash that we have here is that, you know, police have, in many cases, their own agenda that doesn't match the public's agenda of public safety.
Tracy says police could play a much smaller role than they do now. She supports defunding police departments and investing that money in communities instead for infrastructure, schools, social supports, healthcare. Given all that's happened, what do you think are the chances of the time being ripe for that? Or could the country swing into a different direction where people say we need to militarize our police forces further, we need to spend more money on police? I know it's always hard to predict things, but where do you see this going?
Yeah. What I think is that 6 years ago, approximately, we were at a moment after Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri, which people thought was a watershed moment. Mm-hmm. It was a time where people were completely fed up with their relationship with this this arm of the state that, you know, claimed to protect and serve them. And out of that came a lot of work that many people doing that work, including myself, thought was going to be fleeting. That there was a rush to produce some of the recommendations because we wanted to capture the moment. Today, we see police chiefs all across the country who have actively, loudly condemned the horrific incident that we all saw in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair to say that that wouldn't have happened 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say that, you know, that response is a result of some of the work that happened in the last sort of set of upheaval and turmoil around this. So when you ask me, what's my prediction of the future? If the past gives me a basis for predicting the future, that past suggests that we're going to move forward. I don't think it's going to be easy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to be quick. It's going to be heart-wrenching, but I think we will move forward. I don't want to say I'm optimistic. I guess I will just say, I think we will move forward.
That's Tracy Mears. She is a professor at Yale Law School and founding director of the Justice Collaboratory. Earlier on, we heard from sociologist Rayshon Ray from the University of Maryland. He studies bias and racism in policing, and he wrote an essay titled Bad Apples Come from Rotten Trees in Policing. He is not in favor of abolishing or drastically defunding police departments, but he points to other things that need to happen.
For too long, we focused on the bad apples. And even early on in my own work, that's what I did. I focused on how much will body-worn cameras matter to improve policing? How much will implicit bias trainings improve policing? And what I found is that these solutions, while viable and important, they only focus on bad apples. They only focus on individual actors. They don't focus on the system. They don't focus on the structure, on the organizational culture of policing. That's the tree. And so I think there are a few things that need to be done. I think the first is we need a national database on police killings. We only have data on police killings in 16 states. So we know how many people get the flu every year. Maybe not COVID-19 and the coronavirus yet, but we know how many people get the flu, and we actually know how many people get killed by jellyfish. But we don't know how many people are killed by police every year. I think that should bother everyone. I think the second thing is we need to ensure that officers who are fired for police misconduct can never work in law enforcement again. If that was the case, Chauvin, who had nearly 20 police misconduct allegations in Minneapolis, he should have never been on the street. He would have never had his knee on George Floyd's neck, and we might not be seeing protests in the street.
That's Rayshon Ray. He is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Maryland, College Park. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. This week we had engineering help from Al Banks. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.